Hello and welcome to Stepping Into Truth. I'm your host, Omkari Williams, and I'm very glad that you're here with me today. This is the podcast where we take on the issues of race, gender, and social justice. And I love these conversations that I have with people doing work in these realms. But these conversations aren't just meant to be intellectually interesting. They're meant to move us into action, action in our personal area of passion and interest. And at this critical moment in time, each of us is being called to act. But what action looks like depends on who we are, what we care about, and what we have to offer. There's no one way of being an activist. Each of us needs to find our way. And to help you find your way, I've created the Activist Archetype Quiz. And you can find a link to the quiz in the show notes and on my website, omkariwilliams.com. My guest today is Rosalie Fish, a young activist who truly inspires me. She saw a wrong and found her way of bringing attention and action to it. Rosalie Fish is an 18-year-old member of the Cowlitz tribe and a competitive runner from the Muckleshoot Reservation in Auburn, Washington. She graduated in 2019 from the Muckleshoot Tribal School, where she represented her school in the Class 1B Washington State track meet, earned 3 gold medals, a silver, and a sportsmanship award. And she used that platform to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous women. Her passions include running, youth empowerment, Indigenous visibility, upholding and practicing Native traditions, as well as uplifting and advocating for the Native communities and Native women. She's a 2-time TEDx speaker and has worked with countless news networks to raise awareness for the missing and murdered Indigenous women epidemic. Recruited for her running ability and proven leadership, Rosalie attends Iowa Central Community College, and she has continued her career there as an activist and an athlete. The statistics of physical and psychological abuse perpetrated upon Indigenous women are staggering. One report studying the situation in Canada puts the number of Indigenous women who experience this abuse at 84%. That statistic means that this is the norm for Indigenous women, not the exception. In the United States, the numbers are difficult to track for many reasons, including competing legal jurisdictions and remote locations. But the systemic disdain for Native Americans may be at the heart of this neglect. Rosalie Fish is using her running as a way of bringing visibility to this epidemic of violence. So as soon as I learned about Rosalie and what she's doing, I wanted to talk with her. And today is the day. I am so happy to have you on the podcast, Rosalie.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm really grateful to be able to speak with you and to spread awareness on your platform.
Perfect. This is going to be really interesting, I think, because I don't think there's a lot of awareness around this issue, and anything that we can do to bring more people to understand how important this is and what they can do will really make a difference. So I want to start with this. A lot of people in our society still expect girls and women, especially young women, to take a supporting role in pretty much everything, to stay out of the limelight, except in very prescribed ways, and basically to not bring attention to themselves. So when you painted a red hand across your mouth before a race to symbolize the Indigenous women who, missing and murdered, could not speak for themselves, that was breaking that norm in a big way. What was it like when you did that for the very first time?
Definitely at my state track meet, the first time that I wore red handprint, it really was intimidating because I had a lot of people who would openly express their dislike with what I was doing. So for example, I would have people and spectators come up to the meet and say nice war paint to me in a passive aggressive, almost demeaning way. And I would have lots of other athletes as well say like, oh, you have something on your face. And they were very noticeable to me, but also at the same time, very subtle, very passive aggressive methods to try and discourage me from doing what I was doing.
Yeah, that's almost not even passive. That's just flat out hostile. Was that actually, I mean, I could see how that could be a little frightening.
Yeah, I remember actually I try not to emphasize this part of my story because this isn't quite the message that I want to get across. But I will admit that as I was putting on the paint in the bathroom, the public bathroom of the university that I was running at, my hand was actually shaking as I was reaching for the paint, and I was trying to focus really hard not to mess up because I knew that when I stepped out of that bathroom with the paint on, I would be viewed in a different way, in a way that clearly marked me as native and as active and as non-compliant to the types of aggressions that I had. And that's upset a lot of people, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm quite sure that it's upset a lot of people. And actually, I think that the simple fact that it has upset a lot of people speaks to how important it is that you are doing this work, how important it is that you are raising your voice in this particular way. So, you know, there are a ton of people out there who might object to what you're doing, but I guarantee you there are many, many, many more people who have your back on this. So on behalf of all of those people, thank you. Thank you for the courage that you've exemplified in just saying, this is my truth, I'm going to speak it. So something that when I was doing my research before we got on this call, I had seen a Department of Justice statistic that kind of stopped me in my tracks. Mm-hmm. And it is that on some reservations, Native women are 10 times more likely to be murdered than the national average. And this is part of what has inspired you to do this. But I'm curious about your personal experience of this. And would you talk about the murdered and missing women in your own community?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that growing up as a Native girl on my reservation, violence was almost normalized. I would say that.
Wow.
I began to normalize the disappearances of women or the battering of women because it was so common around me within my own family, within my community, and within other Native communities that were miles away from me as well. And I would say I've also had personal experiences with sexual harassment and sexual violence, and that experience had also become normalized to me because that kind of violence is present within generations of women in my family.
What do you think is the reason for that pattern?
I would say it comes with a mix of systematic bias as well as social and I would say social bias as well. I think it's a combination of the two. The social bias, I would say, is present. You can see it today in our mascots, for example, as you see people dressing up as quote unquote Indians, and they have beer cans. And you see instances today where people are, I had a friend recently who tried to fly on the WestJet Canadian airline. And they told her, oh, you can't fly because you smell like alcohol. And I know how you people can't handle your alcohol. And it's this type of social bias that fuels this violence. And then the systematic bias does not address or acknowledge or correct the violence that we're facing.
I'm kind of stunned, both by the experience that your friend had, but also just by how invisible this is in so many ways. I mean, I'm aware, obviously, of the systematic violence that has been done to Native people, but there are nuances to it that I have just clearly not had enough awareness about. So I appreciate having this conversation and having an opportunity to notice what I've been missing, which is kind of ironic considering that the whole thing is missing and murdered Indigenous women, and that there's no way that if this were happening to white women, that this would not be a subject of national discussion and concern. There is simply no way that, proportionately speaking, this many white women could be murdered or go missing and people wouldn't be completely up in arms about it. And I think that that's something that we as a society have to really struggle to understand, not only the roots, because you can see the roots fairly clearly, but our lack of willingness to pay attention to it in the moment. And, you know, it's 2020, and a lot of people who don't live near Native tribes aren't aware of just how pervasive and ingrained the racism still is. And what you said about your experience putting on the hand paint in the bathroom speaks to that. I wonder if for someone of your age, for someone of your experiences, when you, so you've left your reservation, you're at college now. Are you still having those kind of experiences at college?
I would definitely say that I am much less visible here in my new college than I am back on my reservation and back near Seattle. Mm-hmm. I would say that I am very fortunate to live in the Seattle area because it is a very progressive area that is starting to, it is very common to want to be equitable in that area, as opposed to now I'm in Iowa and it's just a different type of social environment where I'm also noticing there's a lot less Native presence in general.
Yes. Where,
so in my hometown, the local colleges were influenced by the reservation and the tribal art and the tribal education. There were land acknowledgments even at times at different colleges in my hometown, as opposed to here, I'm having to politely ask my professor to educate my class with the land bridge theory as a theory and not a fact. And I am just much more invisible here, I would say. At certain colleges, there are First Nations organizations or Native American student clubs, support groups, and I don't have that here as well. So it's a lot more isolating, I would say.
That's got to be really, really challenging for you. How are you sort of engaging with that isolation without having it kind of demoralize you?
It can definitely be a challenge on some days. I came prepared, relatively prepared. I have a lot of my cultural items with me in my dorm that really just remind me where I'm from and why I fight every day. And it just connects me back to the people who fuel me to do better and who fuel me to keep working.
That brings me to another question. I would love for you to tell people the story behind the handprint across your mouth, how that came to be part of what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So the handprint is meant to represent how through the violence against Indigenous women that we have been silenced, that we no longer have a voice. And so it really is symbolizing artistically that invisibility that Indigenous women are facing. With the red, the color is the color of the movement. Mm-hmm. And I think people really just started to utilize that artistic symbol because it's noticeable, because it's not invisible. It makes you completely stand out in a crowd. And I think that was really the intention and the purpose of that red handprint.
It definitely does that. I mean, there's simply no way not to see that on someone. And it's such a powerful statement. And when I saw it, I also thought of blood, you know, and the blood of the murdered women. And it felt so painfully real, you know, the notion of someone's hand over your mouth so you can't make noise, you can't speak for yourself, so you can't be heard was just, it's such a powerful image. And I every single time I see it, it stops me. And I have to think about it again. And I think that's perfect. I think that's exactly as it should be. So something I wanted to ask you about, because I really believe that story has the power to change the world. and that when we share our stories, whether they're our own personal stories or those of others, that we can really touch a chord in people, and that through that we can build bridges from one person to another who may have a very different life experience than us. And I read that when you run for specific missing or murdered women. And I'm curious about how you choose the women that you're running for. Is there a common thread between them, or is it something about them individually that speaks to you personally?
So how I specifically chose the women that I ran for at my state meet, all of these women were related to me in some sort of way, either it be through family or through community. All of the women that I ran for at my state track meet in 2019 were within my community.
Okay. And so
that's how I chose for my state track meet. And now I really just choose stories that I hear about that speak to me, especially ones that are near me, because I'm really adamant about serving my community and serving my home.
How big is the Cowlitz community? How many members of your tribe are there?
So I actually live on the Muckleshoot Reservation, mm-hmm. which is about a few hours from the Cowlitz Reservation.
Okay.
The Muckleshoot Reservation has about 500 people, I believe.
Oh, so it's quite small. So everybody knows everybody.
Absolutely, yes.
Wow, that's such a... It's hard for me to even imagine that. I grew up in New York. Nobody, But so in a community of 500 people where everybody knows everybody, and also you are all related, then one person going missing is a big deal. That's a lot. It's That is a really interesting thing to think about, because it's not like you are in the middle of Manhattan and one person goes missing and you could easily not notice that for a really long time, if ever. If one person goes missing, you're going to notice right away that they're not there.
Yeah.
That must be such a disjointing experience. I mean, what's it like when a woman goes missing on your reservation? What was that experience like for you?
So right now, I have somebody missing who's decently close to me from my Muckleshoot Reservation. She went missing over the summer. Her name is Kaylee Nelson Jerry, and she's been gone for quite a while now. And I can tell you that I'm not the only one who has literal dreams of finding her. I will wake up and I will wake up from a dream where I found her and she was safe and she was okay. And then I have to wake up and it's almost like I'm waking up to the nightmare. I'm waking up to know she's still gone. And when I share this experience with people on my reservation, they'll say, I've been thinking about her too. I dreamt about her too, or I went to a ceremony and she wouldn't leave my mind. And it's really also the psychological effects that these disappearances are having, not even on just the family, but on the entire community. Because when one person goes missing, every single one of us feels that impact.
I would like you to talk a bit more about what that impact actually is for you and for people that you are close enough to really understand what it's like for them as well.
Yeah, I've definitely seen a lot of changes in the way that I maneuver, in the way that I perceive things, especially since taking upon this role as an activist and as a support member for these families and for the women that have gone missing. So my role specifically as an advocate means that I speak a lot to the families who are missing people. And this is very heavy work. I would say that it is very hard to know what to say to a family member who feels like they have no chance of seeing their daughter or their mother or their sister again. And it's not only that these are heavy, but this is repetitive. It's constant. And it really does affect the way that I see things. I think the first time that I really noticed, this was back in June, when I noticed that this work was really changing who I was I was walking with a friend in a shopping center, and somebody came, a woman was sitting down, and she was asking for bus money, and I didn't have any change on me at the moment. And a few years ago, I wouldn't have thought too much about it. But as I walked past her, I thought, what could happen to her? And then the next thing you know, I'm sprinting to my car and I'm digging through it and trying to find just some kind of change to get her maybe somewhere where she's safer. Maybe that's where she's trying to go. And I see myself creating these scenarios now around various women that I see, especially in vulnerable positions, where I feel like I need to do something to help them because they could be next.
Rosalie, you're 19 years old. You're 19. This, I can't even imagine what it's like to walk around with that weight at 19.
Yeah, I would definitely say that I do take maybe a day, a week, if not even two sometimes, just to, or I take that evening and I try to calm myself down, I ground myself, I speak to my family, and I just continue to tell myself, like, they are safe, they are safe. And I'm finding more methods as I'm getting older and more experienced in this work to stay grounded and to stay healthy.
Yeah, because truthfully, this is such painful work. And what you're doing, I mean, people train and get degrees to do the work that you're doing, to do that kind of holding of space for people who are afraid and people who are grieving. So I'm very glad that you are taking care of yourself. And I sincerely encourage you to avail yourself of any resources that will help you to sustain what you're doing. And I mean, that's a big part of activism that is a real challenge, is sustaining. Because some of the work that people do as activists, and you are a perfect example of this, is so emotionally difficult that burnout is a real thing. So it makes me very, it's comforting to me that you have rituals in place, that you have structures in place that are helping you not wind up just completely fried from the emotional weight of this work, this really important but also very painful work.
Yeah, thank you for that. I've definitely spoken with my mentors who've been doing this much longer than me, and they constantly remind me to take care of myself. And one thing I think that really keeps us all going is knowing that if we stop, it's really just accepting what's happening. And to me, no matter how painful the work is, that is the most painful thing I can do, is to stop and to accept the circumstances that surround my family and my community and Indigenous people around the world.
Yes. Thank you. That is beautifully put. Stopping is really not an option. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. So you created a poster that you took with you to the meet you competed in last May. And it was a poster of images of the murdered and missing women. And I'm curious as to what kind of response you got to having their faces right there at this sporting event.
I would say that when people saw the poster, their attitudes changed to be much more sympathetic, which was the goal with the posters, is to really put a name, a face, and a story, a life, to these murders. Because when you just say this person was murdered or a person of this race was murdered, people seem to not really contextualize that kind of loss into their own lives. And so with their faces and with their stories, talking about their relationships, their children, their roles in the communities, how old they were, or I should say actually how young these women were. I think it really got to a few people. And I was that gave me a lot of hope when I saw people I had no idea who they were, drying their eyes when they realized the actual loss, when they really put that into context.
That's perfect, because it's so true. Otherwise, it's just a statistic in our head. It's not a real person. And it's so much easier when you see someone's face and you think, oh my goodness, they're my age, or they're the age of my sister or my aunt, or you can make a connection, and all of a sudden that experience becomes very different and it becomes personal in a way that it isn't otherwise. Otherwise, it's just a name with no context for it. So I think that's such an important thing to do, is to recognize that we do need those stories. We need to understand that there are full human beings with full lives and friends and families and dreams, just like ours, behind mm-hmm. each of these missing or murdered women. It's such a difficult thing to deal with. What would you want to see from law enforcement? Because I understand that there are inherent difficulties, because tribes have their own set of rules and their own law enforcement entities, and mm-hmm. the federal government can't just walk in and do what they want to do. So what is it that you would like to see?
I think what would really create some kind of progress in this epidemic is communication. So, for example, Selena, Not Afraid, some people may have heard of her. She went missing from Montana in January and was recently found deceased when she was 16. Well, she had went missing very close to the reservation border. So she was actually outside of the reservation. So therefore, tribal police only had so much jurisdiction. But then the federal government and the state government did not take action because they were expecting tribal police to do so. And it's these kinds of miscommunications and mix-ups that are costing lives.
So the jurisdictional issues are the central sort of sticking point between the tribes and the federal law enforcement agencies getting involved. So it's those two groups that need to be having communication in a different way than they are. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, definitely.
And that's tricky, because that means giving up power, and nobody likes to do that.
Right. Well, and as you can probably imagine, our tribal governments are also having some, I know lots of tribal members who are now trustful. I have multiple people that I've ran for, multiple women that I've ran for, especially at my state track meet. I believe almost all of the women that I represented were let down by the state police or by the local police. Mm-hmm. I had two of the women that I was representing were shot by police themselves. And the third woman I was representing her death was misclassified as a suicide by the same police department. And it's these kinds of really just distrustful actions that also make this communication and this collaboration so much harder, because when you add the personal biases of some police officers and some department managers, that really makes an impact on the tribal members and the tribal government.
Well, yes. I mean, because honestly, just listening to what you said, all I could think was they're just not putting in their best effort here. They're looking for a quick way to close this case and be done with it because it's not a person whom they value. So racism comes into it again, and that's a really difficult thing to overcome. But I think that just stating it and bringing light to it is potentially a way out of that pattern. You know, just saying, look, this is what we experience, here's what it is, and having other people who are outside of your tribe bring attention to it and say, would you do this if it was the blonde daughter of the person down the road from you? Is this how you would handle that investigation? And insist on the same rigor in their investigation that they would apply if it was someone they knew.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be really challenging, but I think that part of the way to that is just to get more and more people involved in this so that we reach a critical mass around this issue where missing or murdered women from Native American tribes are treated with the same concern that a blonde missing or murdered woman is treated with in this country. So thanks for saying that. That's an important thing for us to pay attention to, because jurisdictional issues should not be why these cases are not being solved and even really looked at in a serious way.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And it can be very frustrating to see either just non-natives and especially, as you said, white women on TV, and they're being reported missing and they're on national news. And here I am, and I'm talking to my relatives, and I'm getting poster after poster after poster of missing Native women. And it can just be very frustrating and disheartening to not see that get any kind of coverage as well.
Yeah, I completely understand. It's the same thing has been said about missing Black women and girls as well. And this is not a situation that can sustain without doing damage to the fabric of our society. We need to treat everyone as if they matter, because they do. So yeah. I had mentioned when we were setting up this conversation that it's really important to me that people listening have things that they can actually do to make a difference in the various causes that I highlight on this podcast. Mm-hmm. And I would love for you to tell people what three simple things they can do are.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that one is there's a lot of mentors in youth, either as coaches, instructors, teachers, tutors, anything like that, people who live around or work around the youth in their lives. I think really just encouraging them to take their form, especially young women, and to be bold and to maybe even do something that, while it might be intimidating, do the right thing, do the thing that matters, and in the way that they can do it individually. Kind of like what you were saying at the beginning of the podcast. And I really think youth right now, we have the position to be heard in a way, because our voices are starting to become a little bit more valuable now.
Yes.
I think people are wanting to hear what the youth have to say. And I think especially young girls, we have the power and the ability, whether we realize it or not, to change the world. And when I put on my red handprint and I painted my face that day at state championships, I did not think I was going to impact anybody but the few people who would care at my meet. And a few months later, I was showing up in like international news. And I think every young girl has the capacity and the ability to make that kind of impact. And I think all they really need is that support, that push, that encouragement.
I completely agree. And I really think it's so important that you said that, because people think, well, what difference is it going to make what I do? But here's the thing is we never know what difference it's going to make what we do. There's no way to know how our action might inspire someone else and what the ripple effect of that will be. So that's a perfect place to start. So have you got two other things that you can share with us?
Yeah, absolutely. And then another legal thing that I think that anybody can do as long as you're 18 is supporting and voting in favor of the 2019 Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act and supporting the Congress people who are supporting that act as well, because it really does have a lot of key aspects of that act that do protect not only Indigenous women, but all women, and especially women in intersectional light. So women of color and really just underserved, vulnerable women are mentioned in this act. And I think it's really important. It hasn't passed yet, as far as I'm aware. And I really think that's a second thing that people can do to protect all women.
Yes, it's very important legislation.
And then the third thing that I would say is for anybody who does listen and learn from this podcast is to educate the people around you who may have misconceptions or stereotypical biases around Native people, whether it be just a lack of education, which is relatively common, or people who think it's okay to dress up as quote unquote Indians and go to football games or basketball games, and people who think it's okay to tokenize that kind of experience. I think really just correcting that in an educational and respectful manner will really make a difference, because with that, you're creating visibility for Indigenous people.
That's so important. As you're saying this, I'm thinking about all of the different teams that have mascots that are related to Native American people, and how uncomfortable it always makes me to see them. I just think, oh my goodness, are we still doing this? And we are. And part of the reason we're still doing it is because we have not educated ourselves sufficiently and have not educated other people sufficiently. So thank you for bringing that up. I think that's a really important thing. And I know that one other thing that you had mentioned to me was to share posters of missing women and girls on social media.
Yes.
And I think that's really important, because again, it gets back to when you see someone's face, when you understand a little bit of their story, it is so much harder to turn away and pretend that it's nothing. It is so much harder. And if we can start doing that on a regular basis, when we hear about a missing or murdered Indigenous woman, pay her the respect of putting her on our social media feed and passing it along and encouraging our friends and families to pass it along and bring attention to this issue so that we can start addressing it. That would be a really good thing to do, a really good use of social media, and takes, you know, 10 seconds of your time, takes no time at all.
Yes, thank you.
So thank you, Rosalie. This was such an important conversation, and I have so much respect for your commitment and your dedication to bringing attention to this truly heartbreaking crisis. I mean, and the attention is really important, because we cannot fix what we don't see. So thank you for helping us see this.
Oh, yeah, no, thank you for giving me an opportunity to share on your platform. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I really appreciate your willingness to take time out of your day and speak to all of us. And to all of you out there listening, I want to just reiterate, each of us has a role to play in addressing the challenges of our world. So be sure to follow the link in the episode notes to my website, where you can find more suggestions and guidance on addressing this issue and also on creating your own everyday activist plan, whether it's about this issue or another issue. Every single one of us needs to be a participant. Every single one of us can make a difference. So I will be back with another episode very soon. Until then, thank you again for listening, and go out and do what you can do.